Welcome to One-on-One with LAPA, the Legislative Analysis and Public Policy Association's podcast series, where experts discuss key issues and emerging topics in the areas of public health and safety, substance use disorder, and the criminal justice system. LAPA is funded by a grant from the Office of National Drug Control Policy, Executive Office of the President. Neither the Office of National Drug Control Policy nor any other federal instrumentality operate, control, are responsible for, or necessarily endorse this podcast. I am Shan Kemper, Senior Legislative Attorney with LAPA, and your host for today's podcast, where we're going to be discussing improving overdose prevention and naloxone availability in the United States. We know that drug overdoses are killing people in the United States at a record rate. This includes Americans of all ages. Researchers estimate that over 900,000 individuals have died from a fatal overdose involving an opioid between 1999 and 2020. And recently, the Center for Disease Control released statistics that state drug overdose deaths in the United States topped 100,000 this year, a record. We know that many of these overdose deaths can be stopped by the administration of life-saving emergency opioid antagonists like naloxone. Thus, it is crucial that we make naloxone accessible to and obtainable for everyone. This is why LAPA is doing a suite of podcast interviews featuring people at the forefront of research and advocacy in substance use and harm reduction and overdose prevention. To that end, I'm honored to talk with my guest, Dr. Aaron Madden, assistant professor at Wayne State University in the Department of Family Medicine and Public Health Sciences. Dr. Madden's research explores healthcare access among marginalized populations, substance use, harm reduction, and social factors that impact healthcare for people who may use drugs. Dr. Madden has published research on a variety of topics, including primary care programs for people with co-occurring mental health and substance use disorders, racial and ethnic differences in naloxone prescriptions, stigma related to substance use and harm reduction, and professional attitudes toward medications for opioid use disorder. Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Madden.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Madden, can you tell our audience a little bit about yourself and the work that you do?
Sure. So I'm a sociologist and a public health researcher. I have training in both fields, and I generally do qualitative research, which means I don't typically do a lot of research with statistics, though I do some of that. I mostly do interview-based and focus group-based research where I'm out in communities talking to people. And I do also interdisciplinary research. So I'll work with biostatisticians, epidemiologists who do a lot of statistical work, as well as physicians, nurse practitioners, physicians assistants who are in the field doing care, but also who do research. And I came to substance use research working with a physician who was a primary care family medicine doctor who also did research. Her name is Miriam Kamarami, and she's now the medical director of the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center. But we started working together when we were both at University of New Mexico. And she was doing a project where she wanted to do more qualitative research, do interviews with people who use drugs and their care providers. And so she brought me onto the project, and she sort of said, you know, what is your experience with substance use research? And I said, pretty much none, because I was just a healthcare researcher at the time. I just was doing research on healthcare access, especially with immigrant populations. And she said, well, what is your experience like with, you know, people who use drugs? And I said, oh, you know, I do have several friends who use drugs. And she said, what about injection drug use or opioids? And I said, yes, you know, I do have a couple friends from college who inject heroin. And she said, okay, you know, so it seems like you have a comfort with it. And I said, oh yeah. And I hadn't really thought about it, but actually my cousin died of an opioid overdose that was prescription related in 2006. And I just hadn't really made the connection with the opioid crisis and sort of her death. And so I started to get more interested in it and thinking about, you know, substance use issues, both as a sociologist, so thinking about the sort of broader structural policies, societal issues affecting people who use drugs, as well as a public health researcher, kind of thinking also about the healthcare system and how we do or don't support those populations. And so I became interested in sort of these questions around 2014, 2015, when I started working with her, and now have my own sort of research program, mostly related to stigma towards people who use drugs, but also stigma towards interventions for people who use drugs like naloxone and like treatment medications.
I actually had a second follow-up question that I had written down, but I actually want to go back to something I think you said that was absolutely fascinating about your history, your interdisciplinary approach to what you're researching and to substance use disorders. And how does that impact the work that you do, an interdisciplinary approach? Because it innately sounds like a good idea, but how does that play out?
Yeah, I think it makes for the most powerful research because you have people thinking about problems from different dimensions. So if you're a sociologist, you think sort of about the structural factors by which we mean policies, societal trends that influence a particular social or health problem. And then you have clinicians like physicians or nurses who are in the field, who are providing services, who have really concrete information about what's working and what's not working and how their, you know, patient populations are really affected. So I think it creates a nice synergy of expertise. And I think in general, right, almost every area of research would benefit from having diverse perspectives like that.
I agree. I think that's a really good point. When I worked at the Kentucky Legislature, and I realized fairly quickly into my time there that a lot of my beliefs about certain things were very ivory tower, quote unquote, and having diverse viewpoints about people who are actually on the ground are, like, as you mentioned, like the nurses and doctors, people who actually see persons who are dealing with substance use disorder. It's probably extremely helpful in your field. My next question is, why should our audience be concerned about accessing or possessing emergency opioid antagonists like naloxone? Why is that a concern?
Well, I think the biggest concern should be getting emergency medications to people who use drugs. Like, that needs to be the main focus. And then the secondary focus is sort of a broader, you know, making sure in general people across society have access to drugs like naloxone. Because I do think we still are not always getting it to the people most at risk, and people who are most at risk are people who use drugs and the people around them, of course. It is important to have people sort of in the general public who have access to these medications, but especially certain members of that general public, people who come into contact with people who use drugs frequently. So by which I mean people like individuals who work at libraries, individuals who work at motels, individuals who work at gas stations, right? So not necessarily who we think of as first responders, though they should have it too. Like, first responders absolutely should have naloxone. But, you know, thinking about other types of professional groups or members of the public who would maybe be at greater likelihood to interact with people who use drugs or come across an overdose. And the reason why we should care about that is that, you know, it works, right? It works to reverse an overdose related to opioids. Unfortunately, it does not work for other types of overdoses, and we don't have drugs to address those, and that's a real problem. But in terms of opioid overdoses, it works. And there's research that shows, you know, that training people in naloxone and overdose reversal actually, you know, increases their knowledge about overdose risk factors. So things like using drugs alone, people will say, oh, I knew I shouldn't be doing that, but now I really know I shouldn't be doing that because who's going to give me naloxone, you know?
Right. That's a great point.
Yeah, and it increases sort of their skills for responding to an overdose. So people know exactly how to use the medication, but also things like putting individuals into the rescue position, which is putting an individual on their side so that if they were to vomit, you know, they wouldn't, you know, breathe in their vomit and potentially suffocate and die. So they're learning these other skills too. And research shows that people get those skills from getting access to naloxone and getting even brief education on it from a pharmacist. We're talking 5 to 15 minutes of education, and we see these outcomes. Obviously, this reduces death. And actually, there's some studies that show a small increase in likelihood of people going to get treatment who have been engaged in a naloxone overdose education intervention. So not a huge increase, but some increase, because people start to sort of think about, how do I, you know, take care of myself? Individuals care that I die, whether I die or not, you know, and that makes people more sometimes motivated or interested in the idea of treatment and reducing or stopping their opioid use.
You mean persons who had the opioid overdose, if they have treatment, were saved by naloxone, or their overdose was stopped by naloxone, there's been studies that show there's an increase in their likelihood to seek treatment?
Typically just someone who's been through a training, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. That's actually really interesting. I didn't know that. And I feel like, so as you know, because you were one of our reviewers, LAPA's going to be publishing a model act on emergency opioid antagonists, with the goal being to get it before policymakers and legislators and say, this is a model that will help, if enacted, help people in your state and hopefully save lives from emergency, you know, as using emergency opioid antagonists to stop an opioid overdose. One of the issues, one of the unique challenges was in writing it, and you were so incredibly helpful with that, is the fact that stigma around harm reduction, around strategies, around interventions is still difficult to ascertain how to stop it, difficult to ascertain how to change ideas around naloxone and around using that. And I know that was one of the challenges in writing the model act. Do you see other challenges in terms of expanding access to naloxone in communities?
Yeah, the two biggest barriers I see are cost and stigma. And so cost is, you know, related to that naloxone, unfortunately, is not free in most contexts. If you go to a regular pharmacy at your grocery store or a chain pharmacy and you ask for naloxone, it's not going to be free. They're going to ask you about your insurance coverage. And insurance coverage varies for naloxone. Some Medicaid programs cover it 100%, but private insurance is not necessarily going to cover it 100%. So you're going to have to pay a copay, you know, or if your insurance plan doesn't cover it, which is possible, you're going to pay the full cost of that medication. So for Narcan, a brand name version of naloxone, where you get two doses in a nasal spray version, as far as I know, last I checked, over $70. So that's a lot of money for people, especially people who use drugs, but even for their friends and family or individuals in the community who might want to be prepared in case they come across an overdose or someone in their family overdoses. That's prohibitive. $70 is prohibitive. I mean, even $10 can be prohibitive. So cost is a big one, you know, but stigma is significant, as you said. So, you know, when we say stigma, people often think of just kind of interpersonal types of stigma attitudes, but stigma is also discriminatory actions and policies that create barriers too. It's not just like prejudice attitudes. And stigma is a huge barrier to naloxone in a lot of different ways. So in one way it can operate is pharmacists can be stigmatizing towards people who maybe need naloxone. They might say, I don't want to stock that because I don't want that person in my pharmacy. There's a lot of qualitative research documenting that among pharmacists. And there's sort of a term that people use for it, which is not in my lobby or not in my pharmacy, which is heralding to the NIMBY, right? Not in my backyard idea. Yeah. So pharmacists not wanting to engage in it. So we have a professional population who can have significant impact if they have stigma. But also, you know, there can be some level of embarrassment sometimes among customers, both among people who use drugs who maybe are searching for access to naloxone, but as well as their friends and family, especially in a rural community where everyone knows everyone, and you go to your community pharmacy and you say, I need naloxone. Other people in the pharmacy might overhear it. You might know the pharmacist. They go to your church, they're at your school, whatever. That can make people not want to ask for it, and then they're not having it on hand.
Right, even though they may need it.
Yeah, and then there's also sort of this idea that I've come across a lot about, you know, if we give out naloxone, that is going to encourage people to use drugs. You hear that among first responders, pharmacists, doctors, the general public. It's a very common belief. There's a word for it in research called risk compensation. And that's the idea that if we give people a safety intervention, it'll change their perception of risk. So they'll think the activity is safer than it really is because we have some sort of intervention to help them make it less safe. So the idea would be like with seatbelts. If we tell everyone, oh, you have a seatbelt in your car, they're going to drive more aggressively, right? For naloxone, if we give everyone naloxone, right, they're going to use drugs in riskier ways. There's no research supporting that happens at all, because people who use drugs do not necessarily want to have to use naloxone, because if you've overdosed and you were to have naloxone administered to you, you go into withdrawal, which is very uncomfortable physically. Like, it's intense flu-like symptoms. No one wants that, right? So people who use drugs are not trying to have naloxone administered to them. And there's just no research showing that giving people naloxone makes them use drugs in riskier ways. But there is that belief out there, and it makes people not want to have naloxone in their communities or not want to personally have naloxone. And so it's one of the drivers of stigma is that attitude.
What was that called? Risk? What's it called?
Risk compensation.
Risk compensation. It's interesting because I think, and I hope that changes. And I've heard personally people who work in the medical field say similar things like that or say things like that. But in terms of risk compensation, I also feel like, and you can tell me if I'm wrong or not, that may also play into how we view drug addiction. Because if you see it as a disease, then you know that someone who has a disease who is struggling with a disease isn't like, well, I don't care if I have diabetes. I know insulin exists. So, you know, I'm just going to eat, you know, it's just how you look. Is it a disease or is it a choice? Is this person making a choice and deciding to risk it all because they know naloxone exists, or is it a disease that they're struggling with and they overdose on?
Yeah, I definitely think the risk compensation idea is coming out of that sort of moralistic or choice idea of substance use, that people choose this, they want to do it.
That's a great way of putting it. Yes. Can you discuss your research on navigating healthcare in communities with limited access to healthcare and how that may have, if it does, any impact on access to emergency opioid antagonists?
Yeah, so I mean, the community that probably has some of the most limits are people who are uninsured, because we do not have, you know, universal healthcare in this country. Access is determined based on ability to pay, and that usually is paid through insurance. So, you know, the cost of naloxone I mentioned earlier, but I also say that there are programs in communities like syringe distribution, sometimes called syringe exchange, that'll offer free naloxone. So if someone is able to access, you know, a syringe program, they might be able to access naloxone even without, you know, insurance. But syringe programs tend to be concentrated in urban areas. Rural syringe programs are very rare. And that's because, you know, there's far distances to travel. The distribution of people who use drugs is much more dispersed. So it's harder to support a syringe program in rural areas. Though many do exist, and those programs are super important, and allowing sort of mobile syringe programs that can go around and distribute syringes and naloxone and do overdose education in sort of like a van, for example, are a big way to counteract those problems in rural areas. And you'll see those in states like Utah, New Mexico. New Mexico especially has had those for decades. As I said, rural communities can be a group with limited access because of the travel issues. Though I will say, so I used to live in New Mexico and did research there. Indian Health Service, which is the federal government program that provides healthcare to Native American populations, has done an excellent job providing naloxone and types of treatment in rural areas where it does exist. So Indian Health Service actually adopted naloxone as a mandatory, sort of as a prescription in their sort of pharmacies, as a mandatory prescription in their pharmacies in 2013 or 2014. I forget the year.
Oh, wow. That's really early.
Yeah. So very early adopters of this. And so they actually are really significant in reducing opioid overdose deaths in rural areas, because while these are programs that generally serve Native populations, non-Native people actually can go to many Indian Health Service or tribally run health centers in rural areas. So these are sort of an under-recognized source of healthcare for rural communities, especially for Native ones, but also for non-Native ones. And, you know, cost and morality also affect, you know, access to treatment. So, for example, like methadone treatment, buprenorphine treatment, as well as counseling services. Most rural areas are underserved for mental health and substance use disorder care. So that can be a real barrier too. But also in urban areas. So I live in Detroit now. In urban areas, you know, we have also access problems that you would maybe only think would happen in rural areas. But if you have poor public transportation, people don't have the ability to get to services. You know, this is happening in urban areas too. Detroit has pretty poor public transportation system, and we have large chunks of the population who do not have a car. So for them to access can be really difficult.
I think that it's both fascinating, like what you mentioned about the Indian Health Services sort of being at the vanguard of, and can you go into that a little bit more? Are they, for the mandatory prescribing of naloxone, is that when you get an opioid prescription, or they're mandated to keep it at the pharmacy?
Yeah, so it's mandatory in their core formulary. So it's mandatory to have at the pharmacy. Not sure that they actually mandate co-prescribing with an opioid. And one of the reasons for that is that not everyone who gets an opioid is necessarily at risk at high risk for an opioid overdose. They could, right? But, you know, it's people who have other types of risk factors we'd want to focus on there, which would be people like who have a past substance use disorder, who maybe are prescribed an opioid with another central nervous system depressant. So something else that slows breathing, like a benzodiazepine, which is a drug like Xanax for anxiety. So we probably want to do more targeted prescribing, as well as availability for anyone, right, who has a friend or family member who maybe would benefit from it. So not trying to restrict it, the prescribing either.
I really like that approach. And I think one of the things we tried to do with the Model Act, as you saw when you were reviewing, is kind of like look at what people are doing and what organizations and states are doing around the country and seeing what sticks on the wall, like throw everything at the problem and what's sticking, and just sort of have a novel approach. Because as I'm sure you're well aware, and as the CDC has mentioned and you read about it, people, and I think you said this earlier in the podcast, people who need naloxone are not getting it. It's not getting into their hands. And enough naloxone, until I had researched the Model Act, I didn't know that you may need more than one dose of naloxone to stop an overdose. So, you know, it's all well and good to have naloxone, but having enough naloxone to impact the problem. What are some of the additional challenges that policymakers may face in addressing stigma specifically around possessing or administering? And you spoke on this earlier, but it's just so interesting to me that we don't really know, I don't want to say know what we're doing, because we're, you know, there's research to say that we don't really know what works in terms of addressing stigma.
Yeah, I would say the field of stigma interventions is very underdeveloped, as you said. That's not being overly critical. That is just very true. Addressing stigma is really hard in many contexts, and addressing stigma related to substance use is something that has not gotten much attention until maybe the last 2 to 3 years. So we know that stigma exists. There's plenty of studies that show that. But then what do we do about the stigma is much harder. It's extremely difficult. I would say a lot of the research on stigma related to naloxone in particular is very new. So research on related types of stigma, maybe towards things like medication treatment, like methadone, or harm reduction more generally, like syringe service programs, that's, you know, that kind of exists. But I would say, you know, a few dozen studies, really just not that much, compared to other areas of research where there's hundreds or thousands of studies, right? So we don't really know how to intervene on stigma to reduce it. That's sort of still an open question. Some of the studies that have been done, probably the most common intervention is something like education for the general public or for providers. Most of it is focused on healthcare providers, so pharmacists, physicians, nurses. And education probably does help. And there's ways in which we can do education that are more effective. So one of the models that has been shown to be more effective is something called contact-based education, which is where you bring in an individual who's from the stigmatized or marginalized group to talk to the stigmatizers and sort of show, you know, I'm human. I'm not scary. You should like me, right? So that sort of has helped in some studies. But really, there's sort of structural changes, like policies, that we really would need to make broader changes, because every educational intervention, you're only getting at the people who are at the intervention and maybe some of their contacts that they'll talk to later. But in terms of affecting broader change, education is probably not going to cut it, because it's such an individualized response to stigma. And we need to address what sociologists call structural stigma. So stigma through policies or through people who enact or enforce, right, policies. And so I do think policymakers, you know, have a real opportunity to have an impact here to reduce stigma and to do things like try to, you know, create laws, regulations that make access to things like naloxone and other harm reduction interventions easier, that is really key. Yeah, so I was really happy to hear about this policy because I think we need it. But it's also hard to think about how do you reduce stigma towards drug use and interventions for drug use in the context of the drug war, in the context of criminalizing substance use. I don't know that you really ever can fully unstigmatize something in the context of the drug war. I think, you know, criminalizing drugs is the main driver of stigma. And if policymakers are kind of unwilling to take on the task of working towards drug decriminalization and ideally, right, drug legalization, there's only so much that stigma reduction interventions can achieve. And I hate to say that.
That's a great point. That's interesting. I had never thought about it in that context. That's interesting.
I mean, I hate to be sort of doom and gloom about it because I don't think we're close to that. But there are examples of, you know, states that have made some progress, right? There, you know, Rhode Island recently passed a law that would allow them to test a safe consumption site. So a site where people can use drugs under the supervision of someone who's trained in emergency response. So they can administer naloxone or other types of emergency care if an overdose were to occur. So there are piecemeal efforts that are happening at state and local levels, but stigma is entrenched in our drug laws that have, you know, decades and decades of history. So it's going to take a long time to undo as well. I would also say, you know, it's not just at the policy level. There's also, you know, kind of community opposition to harm reduction practices too. Members of the general public sometimes oppose, you know, having overdose prevention resources in their communities. In the same way that people oppose, you know, safer sex education, people oppose safer drug use education too in schools and other institutions. And also, you know, some communities and neighborhoods will mobilize against, right, having sites to prevent overdose or distribute naloxone in their community. So Philadelphia, where I'm actually originally from, has been an example of this, where a program called Safe House was going to establish a safe consumption site. And they fought the federal government to be able to do it. The Trump administration sort of sued them and said, you can't do this. And they won. But every site that they've chosen, neighborhood members have mobilized protests against the site, and they haven't been able to establish somewhere. So, you know, it's not just policymakers, it's also community. I would say, you know, there are things that policymakers can do. The model legislation that y'all are working on would be definitely a step in the right direction. Other things that could happen would be like strengthening Good Samaritan laws. So laws that protect people from prosecution who are who experienced an overdose, who are responding to an overdose. In some states, if you're on probation or parole, you don't qualify for those protections. That's not going to work. Like a lot of the people who are involved in drug use are on probation or parole, unfortunately, and they're not going to call for emergency services if you tell them you're going to get a probation or parole violation and potentially go back to jail. So there's things that you can do. Also, assuring harm reduction programs are legal. So there's some states and localities who have sort of gone back in time and decided that they want to make syringe distribution illegal. So in a county in Indiana that happened recently, in New Jersey as well. So policymakers can work on those things too, if they don't feel like decriminalization is really realistic for them.
I like that you ended sort of looking at some of the more positive ways that we can segue, or we can try as a society to segue into working around stigma, maybe, and sort of digging away at it. I really appreciate that. And I also want to thank you so much for talking with me today and talking with us today about your work and about what I think, frankly, is, I mean, of course, COVID being number one, but pressing epidemic of our time. I really appreciate it. And that's all the time we have today, but I want to thank Dr. Madden for speaking with me today. If you would like to reach out to her with questions or comments or speaking engagement inquiries, please do so at efmadden, M-A-D-D-E-N, at wayne.edu. If you would like to learn more about improving overdose prevention and naloxone availability, please check out LAPA's Model Act, the Model Expanded Access to Emergency Opioid Antagonist Act. You can also check out LAPA's comprehensive summary of state laws on naloxone. Both of these documents can be found by logging on to legislativeanalysis, that's one word, .org, or contact LAPA at info@thelapa.org. And please join us for the next one-on-one with LAPA, where we will discuss another interesting topic. Thank you so much.